All right, here we go. Quiet!
Quiet! Quiet!
Roll them!
Hello and welcome to the Big Picture Podcast, where we take a look at the latest movie news, the films of yesterday and today, and try to make it all make some sort of sense. I'm your host, editor-in-chief of Film Buff Online, Rich Dries. Across the microphone from me would normally be my co-host, Film Buff Online contributing editor, Natasha Bogutsky. However, we're both kind of really crazy busy right now with some other things, as we sometimes do, and that's why we take some short hiatuses here on the podcast. However, we got an opportunity to do an interview with an author, and I wanted to, you know, make that happen because A, I know the author, and B, I read his new book and I really enjoyed it, and I think it's something that our audience would be very interested in. So this is kind of like a special mid-hiatus bonus episode for everybody here. It's an interview I just did a couple days ago with writer Tom Shibula, who also lives in our corner of Pennsylvania, and on the occasion of the publishing of his second book entitled James Bond and the 60s Spy Craze. I'm sure you all know that in the 1960s, after the James Bond movies were gigantic at the box office and seeped into the public consciousness in a way that nothing really had before. Everybody else wanted a piece of that financial pie. So there was a lot of knockoffs, imitators, parodies, satires, etc., etc. Everything from like TV series like The Man from U.N.C.L.E. or the comedy Get Smart to a couple of movie series with like Dean Martin's Matt Helm series and a couple of other things. And Shibula takes all of that and kind of charts that whole history out through the 60s and into the 70s. And he just doesn't do it with American films. He does it worldwide because there's some countries, their film industry just loves to make knockoffs of stuff. So he really dug deep. I mean, this is a topic I've always been interested in to begin with. And he dug deeper than I've even seen for some really hidden gems, or at least hidden films from like South America and things like that, that I had not even heard of. And it's a great book. It's a great overview of the whole thing. And just a couple of days ago, we sat down in a coffee shop and had a great conversation. So here it is, and please enjoy. I'm here with author Tom Shibula at a secret clandestine location, a coffee shop. And we're not very clandestine because we've got microphones set up.
Microphones sitting here in the coffee shop.
True. And we're here to talk about his brand new book, James Bond and the 60s Spy Craze.
Yes.
So first of all, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm excited to talk to you about this.
Yeah, you know, and it's I'm always really excited to talk about it, and really any of my projects, I just anything that I write about are projects that I care a lot about and obsess over, and I'm sure you're the same way.
Oh, good God, yes.
So over the past 2 years, I have been obsessing over just that, over James Bond and the subsequent knockoffs and spoofs and adjacent films that came in the 1960s.
Okay, well, how did you come to this obsession to write about it then, I guess, is our first
question.
I've
always loved James Bond and spy movies and the 60s movies. My first book was entitled Primetime 1966-67. It was about the first season every show was in color. And I kind of came about it two ways. Number one, the original plan was Beatles, Bond, and Batman. That's always been kind of a core obsession of mine, is that late 1960s, there were the Beatles, James Bond, and Batman. And then everything that's spawned off of those three things. And then two summers ago, I was in... I was on vacation, actually, and I was reading a spy novel written by my friend Gary, and it was kind of a period piece, and I started reading it, and then I started thinking about James Bond films. I started thinking about spy films, And I just started writing, and I, again, much like my first book, I didn't know what it was going to be. I didn't know it would turn into a book, but I knew I had something.
As a Bond fan already, was the research period not as long as maybe you think it would be for another book?
No, it definitely was, because, well, it was all
at your fingertips? Or?
I knew where to look, certainly, and, mm-hmm. and I one thing that I like to do in my books is not necessarily give you information that you would have gotten in 2024, 2023, or whenever I wrote the book. I wanted to look at from the time. So it, almost looking at it from a historical perspective, like here, if you were reading the newspaper in 1963, this is the information that you would have about the book. I tried to keep kind of a modern perspective and a modern look at things as far away from it as possible, if that makes sense.
Okay. I got the book over the weekend, but I was at a film festival all weekend with my own things, and so I hadn't had a chance really to dig too deep into it. But one thing, you know, I noted you you cover a lot of ground in terms of like some of the other main franchises that kind of were born out of this, like Matt Helm or Harry Palmer, and of course
and
Flint.
Like Flint. Yeah.
Yep. But you also kind of dig deep into some of like the weirder European and South American knockoffs.
Latin American knockoffs, the one criteria that I had, it had to have played on television or in a theater in the 1960s for it to qualify. The Eurospy genre was vast, and I think I'd still be writing the book if I included every Eurospy book. And there is a book about Eurospy that's pretty comprehensive. And not all of them are James Bond adjacent necessarily. Not all of them are, you know, a true knockoff of James Bond. They just happen to be a spy film. Whereas most things in America, were direct. And that's the one other thing that I always tried is that it had to have some James Bond adjacent. So whether the comparison was made, they were trying to do something similar to James Bond, or in the case of a lot of them, push the boundary with James Bond, because I think a lot of those spoofs and a lot of those knockoffs gave their characters more outlandish plots, more outlandish gadgets, which almost pushed Bond into that, making him like a quote-unquote super spy.
Okay, now I'm a child of the 70s and 80s, so I've seen, lived through the whole Star Wars repositioning of the zeitgeist, and then everybody chasing after Star Wars.
Well, and they did that with James Bond with Moonraker. You know, give us one of those.
There's a thing about the 60s where the Bond films set the standard that everybody chased, and then it seemed like in the 70s,
Bond was
chasing things like Star Wars with Moonraker or
Dirty Harry. He chased blaxploitation films.
Yeah, blaxploitation films with Live and Let Die is what I was trying to pull up. And so what was it about the Bond films that everybody, besides, okay, maybe it was just the dollars, but what was the about the Bond films where everybody says, we need us one of them?
Well, they were really the first, I guess, in modern sense, action film. Very few films before that really had that much action, where it was like these chase scenes, elaborate chase scenes, car crashes, explosions, things like that. You know, even if you look into, you know, like a film noir film, there'd be maybe a foot chase here and there, but it was never elaborate. Where Bond kind of brought in that kind of elaborate chase, elaborate action, that certainly set the standard for it. And there was a fair amount of sex as well. So sex and violence. There we go. It's the things people really love. So sex and violence certainly.
Not necessarily
helped
at the same time, not but.
Sometimes.
Well, wait, what?
So that certainly set the standard where, you know, you have sex, you have violence. Previous to 1962, you know, you didn't really have it. It was more implied.
Well, you had a loosening and pretty much a dissolving of the production code right at that time too. Yeah. So I'm sure that had to have played a part of it.
Right, and certainly, and the fact that they were British made, you know, that certainly, you know, they kind of had a different standard of rating, and I'm sure we could do a whole podcast on that. But yeah, no, by 62 in America, there certainly was a loosening of the production code, and by 69, it was completely abandoned. I have a really great story in the book talking about Salt and Pepper, which is the Sammy Davis Jr. and Peter Lawfer spy spoof. And that was one of the first movies to get like a rating. And I think it had the R rating. And there was a conversation like, well, what happens if somebody from under 18 goes to buy a ticket? What do we do?
You know? Well, it's legally enforceable.
Right, right.
Yeah, it's just a guideline.
Right.
And also, too, I think it's interesting because this is like the first real, like, big franchise. I mean, you had series pictures before under the studio system, like anything from like Andy Hardy to The Thin Man, one of my all-time favorite, The Saint, The Falcon,
right.
Maisie, all those. But you never had something like Bond before.
Right. Yeah, I know. And there's a reason why. I mean, Bond and Godzilla, I mean, are the two kind of real continuous franchises to the current day. And yeah, I think those early ones were under the studio system, and none of those really have ever translated to modern audiences. As much as I love The Thin Man, you know, it's hard to.
Yeah, it is
like
a little
modern
bit.
Audience.
I mean, you can
kind of
link it to like
Man.
Moonlighting or Remington Steele, maybe. But even that, I'm talking 40 years old now,
right?
Which makes me want to crumble into a pile of dust and blow away in the wind.
We're close to that.
I know. So, yeah. So, basically, you're saying then that, you know, the Bond movies were popular. The knockoffs tried to outdo Bond, and then Bond had to outdo its own imitators.
Correct.
And
yeah.
That's what kind of pushed it. Would you say that's ultimately why there's such a remarkable difference between, like, the main core Connery films, and I would lump in Lazenby's Honor Majesty's Secret Service, and the majority of the tone of the Roger Moore films, and I would kind of push Diamonds Are Forever more towards that, because it definitely felt like a Roger Moore film before they put Roger Moore in.
Right. Yeah, they probably should have just hired Roger Moore at that point. I think he was being held back with the Persuaders, but to take on Diamonds Are Forever. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, that's absolutely what happened. It was trying to chase something else. It was chasing its imitators, and then it was chasing other popular films that outdid James Bond.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I almost would argue that in the 80s, when they started to have some legal issues and there were long gaps between films while people were having fights in court and everything, it was probably for the best, because you get a soft reset with Timothy Dalton, a bit of a reset with Pierce Brosnan, and then, of course, Daniel Craig is
hard
a complete do-over.
Pierce Brosnan ones, there was a, seemingly at the beginning of GoldenEye, there was at least a feel of a reset, I guess. And I always love every new James Bond film. We're getting back to basics. That's always this. I'm always like, well, what is basics? Like, you know, it's always, and then it gets out of control. You had with GoldenEye, you had very few gadgets. I think the wristwatch with the laser, that was kind of the biggest. And then by a later one, it was an invisible car.
Yeah, that was Die Another Day.
And
that was like. No offense to Mr. Brosnan, but that might have been one Bond film too many for him.
Because
it was not. And when they announced, we're getting back to basics with the new guy, I was like, oh, good. And then they did Casino Royale, which really felt like one of the old school, you know, novels. They didn't really deviate too much from that, which was nice. But let's get back to the 1960s, though. Let's take a look first at the main imitators, pretenders to the throne of Bond.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Matt Helm series, Harry Palmer, and In Like Flint. Which was your favorite?
Who? I really like the Mannheim films with Dean Martin. I think they're pretty cool. Mm-hmm. They're really tongue-in-cheek. They don't really take themselves too seriously. It's peak Dean Martin as well. I'm just kind of being a drinking womanizer Dean Martin.
And he just happens to be a spy as well.
Right.
Which is, I mean, if you're looking to play off of that womanizing aspect of Bond and the drinking aspect of Bond, I could see where Dean Martin cranks it up to 10.
Yeah, and certainly, and had, I think, cranked up kind of the Bond girl thing to 10 mm-hmm. by having that. I definitely have to go go Dean Martin with those. I don't really have a particular reason other than I think it's they really did a good job of spoofing. Mm-hmm.
And it was based on a series of books themselves.
Yes. Yeah. So they were actually pretty good sellers. Pretty good. They sold very well, mm-hmm. as well as, you know, James Bond film, along with James Bond books.
Yeah. You know, for personally, I'd like the Flint films. Mm-hmm. It's a low status of entry if you're looking to watch all of them because there's only two.
There's only two. Yeah.
Whereas what? There's four Harry Palmer films and five Mannheim.
Five Mannheim. Yeah.
Okay.
There were supposed to be six, but apparently Dean Martin didn't show up.
Whoops.
And then they just kind of canceled it.
Yeah,
and
that's fair.
By that point, again, and I think, it's really funny that all of these films, aside from James Bond, I mean, everything really fell apart by 1970. You know, mm-hmm. it was, in this book, I tried really hard to, stick within the 1960s, and that was kind of my goal, and it, I thought it was going to be difficult, and it wasn't. Everything fell apart late 1969, 1970.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because, you know, from like, I would say 67 through into 70, 71, 72, great social upheaval going on.
Mm-hmm.
And very quickly, a lot of that stuff probably became passé in the culture, you know, with the hippie movement, disillusionment of Vietnam, starting women's rights movement, stuff like that. Would you say, how does Bond survive through that, where so many of these other Bond, franchises again, kind of went...
Bond reinvented himself a little bit. And Bond was just became iconic where the others were imitators. You know, it was... even like a horror film franchise, you know, sometimes there's like an original that kind of sticks around and then there's the imitators. They don't really stick around too much. And they knew what they had and they knew they were able to, some people knew when to go away and then Bond knew, you know, we still have something here. And, you know, and that's one of the reasons why, George Lazenby, left. You know, because he kind of figured, well, people aren't going to be interested in James Bond anymore. This may be a bygone era. This may be by 1970, you know, the world changed again, you know, and maybe people wouldn't be interested in James Bond. And he even had a quote, something like, I'm about peace now or something like that.
Yeah.
And,
which is, on a certain level, I think it's a shame because I think he does a really great job in the film. And I think, to quote them themselves, it's kind of a bit of a back to basics Bond. You don't have as many gadgets and things like that on Her Majesty's Secret Service. It has a character arc. It has a very poignant ending, which does get referenced, in future films, obliquely mostly. But I always wondered, it was like, man, if he had stuck with that franchise, where would it have gone, or would it have? Would have moved in like a more dramatic
that's possible. More dramatic direction, maybe it would have fizzled out too. Who knows?
Yeah.
You know, it may have been good that there was three Bonds in three movies.
True. But I think that also demonstrated the flexibility of the franchise.
Sure. Yeah. And it definitely there was a lot of flexibility. And again, even in the 1960s, I always think like throughout, especially those early Bonds, the world changed a lot, you know, from 62 to 65. the world was a much different place. You know, you had, you know, the assassination of President Kennedy. You had, you know, escalation in Vietnam. You had a lot of social upheaval where Bond, originally kind of working for like a Western government, was okay. And then all of a sudden, you know, Bond was kind of a square, I guess, on the surface.
I mean, you start, you know, very much in the depth of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even by the mid-70s, when I start to have, you know, memories of like first grade, second grade and stuff like that, Cold War didn't seem like as big a deal. People weren't doing a lot of duck and cover drills anymore and stuff like that. So, you know, I can see where that initial mission of Bond, if you will, you know, to protect the... And that's something... I interviewed John Gardner, one of the Bond novel extension writers, years ago. And I said, you know, how do you keep Bond relevant? And he's like, whatever it is that is a threat to the British Empire. And so you can talk about, you know, okay, a giant drug cartel needs to be taken out by Bond because they're flooding the streets of London with heroin or whatever.
Right.
Or you have a megalomaniacal guy in a spaceship with poison gas that he's going to flood the Earth with so he can restart humanity.
And then even, you know, the, oh, gosh, the world is not enough. It was a newspaper magnet.
Yes.
Or media magnet.
Media magnet. Very thinly disguised version of, not Murdoch, but...
Yeah, Murdoch. I always thought it was Murdoch.
Was it Murdoch? Or was it the other guy who owned... the Star, and then drowned when he fell overboard.
Right, I forget
off
his
of
name.
His yacht. Yeah, I can't remember his name either. So much for all that money. Don't remember your name, buddy. So, let's go back though. I was not familiar with any of the Latin America Bonds. Knockoff stuff.
Right.
It came as no surprise to me that, of course, you know, like Santo the Wrestler had one.
So Santo, one of my favorite things to talk about. Santo, for those of you who don't know, was a Mexican wrestler.
Mm-hmm.
Masked Mexican wrestler. He had his own line of comic books in Mexico. It lasted a very long time. He was Mexico's resident monster hunter in the films, fought every conceivable classic monster across the board.
I have a disc of him as Santo versus the Blob, but it's not a big red jelly-like monster, which was a little bit of a surprise, but okay.
It's a lot of people in a rubber thing.
Yes.
So Santo, he fought the Blob, Dracula, Wolfman, Frankenstein, witches, zombies... Martians, you name it, he fought it. Anyway, 1966, turned in his monster hunting hat for his spy hat. Became a spy in a film, Operation 67. And thankfully, I desperately wanted to write about a Santo movie. And again, I had that criteria of it had to have played in America in a theater. And I found that it played in a drive-in in El Paso, I believe. And great. Okay. Wonderful. So it got included in the book. However, his tag team partner, the Blue Demon, was in two spy films. That did not make the cut, unfortunately. Blue Demon, Destructor of Spies, and Passport to Death, which was the sequel. So he was in some cool retro 1960s spy films as well. There was also another guy in the that's included in the book, Alex Dynamo. And pretty explicitly, every interview I find is, no, this is the Latin American James Bond. They are saying, no, we're knocking. He's our own guy now. Like, Alex Dynamo is our guy.
Mm-hmm.
So...
How effective of a spy can you be with a luchador mask on? That's what I'm sitting here wondering right now.
Didn't really seem to. Again, Blue Demon, El Santo, two guys, two masks, wrestlers that never took their masks off. Mm-hmm. Like, never. Not even to go undercover. And again, and a secret identity is only good when you're another guy. Batman becomes Bruce Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
Superman becomes Clark Kent. They're another guy. El Santo was always El Santo. Whether he was... So it would be like Batman just wearing the outfit all the time, like going to Wayne Enterprise board meetings in his Batman outfit. There's a reason why he wears the mask. Yes.
Okay. Okay, let's hop across the Atlantic then to Europe, because I've seen, you know, obviously the British were doing their own James Bond riffs.
Yep.
I know later on the French were doing something
with the
OSS series.
Yes.
But that came after the 60s, if I'm correct.
They were not included in the book, and I don't think they really played in the States too much.
Mm-hmm. And then some Italian films,
a lot of Italian films, a lot of European co-productions. A lot of them you run across. It was kind of this Italian, West German, Spanish, French conglomerate of films. Certainly Italian, and I think one of the best being Secret Agent Super Dragon.
Okay.
Which I think is one of those films that really did push the boundary of for James Bond. You know, kind of they made him go above and beyond with what he was already doing.
Mm-hmm. One that I've seen, even outside of it being on Mystery Science Theater 3000, is Operation Kid Brother.
Yes, with Sean Connery's younger brother, Neil, who is not an actor. He's a house painter. And somehow they convinced him to make his own film. And Operation Kid Brother, or also known as OK Connery.
Mm-hmm. Which is amazing to me is they got Adolfo Celli from Goldfinger.
Miss Moneypenny?
Miss Moneypenny, Lois Maxwell. Bernard Hugh?
Yes.
Yeah. And I was surprised that Lois Maxwell and Bernard Hugh were allowed back into the main franchise after doing doing such a knockoff like that.
Yeah,
there had to have been some repercussions.
There had to have been. Again, at the time, I found article after article stating that Sean Connery was mad at his brother over this. But I couldn't find anything concrete. I could never find an interview with Sean Connery where he directly talked about it, saying, yeah, I was upset. The only thing that we really had, I think Neil Connery kind of said, no, Sean's okay. Don't worry about Sean.
I know if my brother's mad at me, I'm not telling everybody either, but, you know, so I'm going to take that with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
But that takes some balls to do, I think.
Yeah, and it was a direct knockoff, because they even specifically mention 007. You know, they specifically mention that he's James Bond's brother.
Yeah.
I think they may say 007. They don't say James Bond specifically, but there is a movie. There's a British movie. It's called The Second Best Secret Agent in the World. And that movie, James Bond does, the character James Bond, specifically mentioning James Bond, dies in the first part of the scene. The first part of the movie. So they get the second best secret agent in the world to take his place on the mission in Avengers Death.
It's crazy that they would skate that close right over the borderline,
especially
really.
In a English film, you know, it's kind of Italian films are kind of notorious for that. You know, there's a million Terminator knockoffs and Alien knockoffs in Italy and things like that.
Lord knows I've seen some Italian science fiction films where they just lifted wholesale, like, video visual effects shots from Buck Rogers and Battlestar Galactica, stuff like that.
Yeah, so, Italy I see. England, I would think it was a little bit, you know, in a country that respects copyright laws.
Yeah, it's crazy. One other thing I kind of thought about, too, while I was going through the book, and it just kind of reinforced something in my mind, was the leap to comedy versions of a James Bond film seemed really fast. Usually it feels like something becomes the craze, it lasts several years, and then the parodies become the tail end of that craze. Mm-hmm. Like, what was the distance in time between Star Wars and Spaceballs? Like 12 years or something like that? This was like 12 months, it feels like. You know, and suddenly Marty Allen is out there with the last of the secret agents.
Yeah, 1966 was seemingly the peak era of everything. That's when, and that was the high tide of the spy craze and the high tide of 66, 67 again. And that seems to be my wheelhouse. That's my strike zone.
Mm-hmm.
That's where everything kind of hit. It was television. It was spoofs. It was knockoffs. A ton came out in 1966.
Mm.
So, I don't know. Everybody was just fighting for a piece of the pie on this one. I don't know.
You know, and sometimes I wonder, too, if... because this is something I'm fascinated by. In, like, the late 60s, early 70s, when a lot of old guard entertainers were looking at the new younger generation and not getting it at all or trying to still be relevant. So you'll have like Jack Benny show up on his show wearing like a Sergeant Pepper's jacket or a neighbor jacket or something. And I sometimes, and, or they'll make hell, the Bond franchise itself made fun of the Beatles. You know,
it's like,
and then 5 years later,
it's like Goldfinger. It's like listening to the Beatles without earmuffs.
Yes, and then four films later, Paul McCartney's doing your theme song.
Yeah, you're right. I never thought of that. You know, even in Batman, the Batman the TV show, the last season of Batman, I always thought that these old actors. You know, they flooded the show with these old actors like Ethel Merman, you know, Milton Berle, Zsa Zsa Gabor, you know, people that were like, you know, just trying to stay relevant, and that's why that last season was awful.
It was crazy.
Instead of appealing to a younger crowd, it was like, no, let's appeal to people like an older generation in the 60s.
So I'm thinking back even to like Otto Preminger.
Who played
Mr. Freeze on Batman, and then he directed Skidoo, which is, I think, the pinnacle of old Hollywood trying to be relevant and hip and
just
not
completely missing the mark.
Yes,
that's exactly what that film is old Hollywood just desperately clinging to some counterculture film and just. Falling apart.
Yeah, you know, and crazily enough, that Harry Nilsson documentary that came out a couple years ago had a clip from Nilsson being on Playboy After Dark again. You know, early 60s trying to still remain relevant. Preminger was on there promoting Skidoo because if you look in the background of these shots, you can see him in like the Nehru jacket and everything.
Nice.
And it's just like, oof.
The Nehru jacket was the absolute I'm trying to stay relevant look in 1967.
Yeah, for about 4 months, and then
no,
everybody moved on quickly. but yeah, it's always interesting to watch that struggle there, and the Bond franchise I think got through most of that relatively smoothly.
Yes, yeah, they especially in the 1960s. Were not desperately trying to cling to relevance. They did not have Sean Connery in hippie beads and
a frilly shirt.
A frilly shirt and peace necklace. They didn't grow out his hair. He was still appropriately square. And not to say that James Bond isn't cool, but
I mean, a tuxedo is a tuxedo.
Yeah, right,
you know,
correct.
And it has a certain cachet, I guess you fashion cachet across anything, I guess.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. James Bond did not try to radically change his look throughout the 1960s to stay hip or young. Although in You Only Live Twice, he did try to become Japanese, but that's a story for another podcast.
Very much so. Yikes. That's a fun movie, though. I mean,
yeah.
You know, you've got ninjas in a volcano lair. That's, you know, quintessential Bond right there.
And they did it for no reason, by the way. There's no real rhyme. I love that movie. And I'm like, why did they do this?
So he could go undercover in that fishing village for about 4 seconds. It's like, ugh. I mean, and somewhere I'm sure Mickey Rooney is just sitting there going, and you yelled at me? So, what was the hardest film to track down that you knew you wanted to include?
There was a couple films that I certainly had to send away for the DVD, kind of a on gray market, convention-y DVDs. Spy in Your Eye, Operation Thunderbolt, and it was a Swedish film, Strike First Freddy, I think it's called.
Okay.
And those three, I remember specifically. I went through the usual sources. I say, okay, can I stream it? No. Can I buy the DVD? No. Is it on YouTube? No. Okay. All right. So I had to find, kind of a third rung of, again, convention DVR type stuff. I'm sure the copyright is in some weird legal limbo in Bulgaria. Mm-hmm.
Dare say I have a few of those titles myself at home.
Yes.
Was there anything you couldn't find, or did you make it a point to watch everything you were talking about?
Yes.
Or were there a couple of titles that
I
you were
made
like...
it a point to watch everything?
Okay.
And I did find. I mean, at least if it played in the United States, I mean, you could find it, you know. I think that there was some that I couldn't necessarily find the entire film, but for the most part, I got the gist of the film.
That's fair. If you were going to recommend just a couple of the deeper cuts, not like Matt Helms or anything like that, but say, Operation Kid Brother or something like that. Which would be the ones that you would say, oh, you know what? This was a low budget knockoff, but it was actually really well worth my time.
So certainly the one that I mentioned of Secret Agent Super Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
I love that film, and it was a Mr. Science Theater as well. I think I first saw it on Mr. Science Theater, but definitely a cool film just to watch on its own. I think another cool one, again, something that I mentioned, A Spy in Your Eye.
Mm-hmm.
Really cool film. Electronic eye was placed in somebody's head, and so the bad guys could spy.
Oh, that sounds
fun. On everybody. It's a really cool film. That Man in Rio, which was really early onto the spy genre.
Mm-hmm.
And very serious. Apparently Steven Spielberg really loved the film, referenced it for Indiana Jones and things like that.
Okay.
Certainly that. I'm trying to think. There was a bunch. I don't know. I watched for a podcast where you watch a film and talk about it. Last of the Secret Agents, and the podcast host hated me for making him watch Last of the Secret Agents with Marty Allen. So Nancy Sinatra.
Nancy Sinatra. Okay.
And that was right before she did her own.
Mm-hmm.
And I would recommend any of the shows. Secret Agent Man, The Prisoner, Avengers, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Man from Uncle, Girl from
Man
Uncle.
Man from Uncle, Girl from Uncle, all of those.
First television universe.
Get Smart.
I was going to say, I'd seen Last of the Secret Agents years ago when Turner Classics ran it. And
I'm sorry.
Once was enough. Once was good. I was like, okay, I'd knock this off. But I've always had at least a mild interest in films that have spun off of the Bond franchise. So yeah, I've seen Fathom and the Flynn movies, the Harry Palmer films, Matt Helms, stuff like that. And I found it weird that even other franchises would kind of hop on that bandwagon as well. I'm thinking specifically of, and this is something I mentioned to you before a couple of weeks ago when we were at the that movie screening for Kevin, Carry On Spying.
Oh,
from
right,
the Carry
right.
On series of British comedies.
Yes. That was a tough one as well. Carry On films, they must have been, and I like British humor.
Mm-hmm.
Some things, maybe it's just a little too British for me. I don't know. Maybe I just don't get them. Carry On Screaming was okay. I'm not really that well versed in the Carry On franchise, so maybe there's something I missed.
The Carry On Spying was actually my first Carry On film, so that didn't really endear me much to the franchise, I'll admit. But, you know, since then, people have said, go back and see some of the early ones, like Carry On Sergeant, the one that's set in the Navy. And, yeah, there are a lot of wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more, squaw. You know, after I started to get familiar with, like, some of them, because it's very, you know, kind of like vaudeville bawdiness.
Right.
I had to think that that's what they were doing in Python, was just taking the piss out of Carry On films.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, it was not a good introduction, but
I think we were talking about the last Carry On was Carry On Emmanuel, which was of the Emmanuel kind of softcore porno films.
Yes,
which I can't imagine that being very good.
No, and then they tried to relaunch it in like the early '80s with Carry On Columbus. And I only saw that as a Doctor Who fan because John Pertwee was in it for about 4 seconds.
I never saw any
of
those.
And they had some other British comics in there. The only other one I can remember was Dennis Cleary, I think his name is, who, you know, was on the original Whose Line Is It Anyways? But anyways, we're wandering far afield here.
I've never wanted to stay on track here.
No, neither am I. So... do you think that any of the Bond knockoffs could ever be successfully revived, or are they just too much of a 60s product?
And you know, even sometimes you get a movie where they revive it and people are like, well, that's a title.
That's a choice.
Like, that's a choice. Like, okay, why are you going to... And then it's... Again, it's just revised because it's a name.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw recently that there's a movie, I think it's starring somebody from Stranger Things and somebody from Euphoria, but it's Faces of Death.
Wow.
Yeah. Yes. Faces of Death.
A feature film based on a fake documentary from the 80s.
Correct.
Okay.
And I'm going, well, what's that? And then I said, well, it's a title. And they probably won't even, there'll probably be a loose reference to a VHS tape. They'll maybe set it in the 80s. Other than that, I don't think they're going to be eating monkey brains in it.
No.
I don't think there's going to. Again, sometimes something is made because it's a title.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if any of those other films are a title. Maybe in like Flint, that could be something that's like somewhat recognizable.
I think in like the early 80s they tried to revive it. Harlan Ellison was involved with it somehow, I seem to recall.
Yeah.
And
Matt Helm they tried to recreate for television in the 70s. That didn't really work. And again, even at that point, those were still in kind of recent memory. If you were an adult, you know, maybe you remember it as a child, you remember the name, or you know, or you saw it as a younger adult. Whereas you know, now we're so far removed, I can't imagine a title where somebody would say, oh, that's a thing. I mean, they did it with Man from Uncle, Avengers you can't do now because everybody thinks it was Marvel. Yeah. Get Smart, it's been done. So TV
and being done again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So TV maybe like a Secret Agent Man, Danger Man or something like that. Again, it's a title, but and any similarities to this 1960 film or television may be purely coincidental.
I know a few times when they've tried to do Avengers as a comic book, you know, in the last 20 years or so, it's always been Steed and Mrs. Peel.
Mm-hmm.
Not the Avengers, obviously. But even then, it felt like this is a nostalgia piece for fans of the old series, and it never really felt like it needed to be brought into the present.
Yeah, very few things do.
Yeah. So.
Again, and sometimes it's you look at it, and you go, okay, that's a title that I know, and that's about it.
So what is next? You said you were all about Batman, Bond, and the Beatles. Is the next book the rock and roll movies of the 60s?
It's not a bad idea. So, okay, my only problem is, my agent tells me that books about a singular subject sell more now.
Okay.
So I need to find a an exact film to talk about, or a biography or entire film, and maybe we'll build around that. I don't know. I've been kicking around some ideas. I don't. Long story short, I don't have a
nothing
project right now. No.
Okay. All righty. Oh, man. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Problem.
This was a great, great discussion.
I
hope
fun.
You enjoyed yourself.
I did.
All right. Thank you again, Tom.
Thank you.
Okay, that was our conversation with Tom Shibula, the author of James Bond and the 60s Spy Craze. This book is available wherever you go. I've been a couple of places and have seen it at, you know, like your Barnes & Nobles, your everything. It's from Applause Books, who is a great publisher of books on film and television and theater history. I have in my reference library, as I jokingly call my spare bedroom, that's just full of bookshelves with books. I have a number of books from that publisher, and they're always worth a read. And Tom's book especially is. It's a wonderful, wonderful book, and highly recommended it here from us at the Big Picture Podcast. Now, we're going to be back. Like I said at the top of the show, this was just a mid-season hiatus, kind of bonus episode that we were dropping. We will be back, hopefully, let's see, probably not going to be until the end of June, though, simply because we're both taking some vacation time. We both have a couple of projects that we need to finish off because of deadlines, and by the time we'll be able to get back to you all, it's probably going to be about mid-June, it's going to be before July 4th, I promise you that. So hopefully you guys can hang out, talk amongst yourselves, and we'll be back in about 2 months. And we thank you for your patience there, and we'll see you then. Until then, once again, I'd like to thank Tom Shibula for a wonderful chat. I'd like to thank the coffee house that let us set up in a corner with some microphones and didn't kick us out, even though we sat there for almost an hour. And always like to thank you. We'll be back next time. But until then, remember, you can find us at all your favorite podcatchers, and please leave a review if you like what you're hearing, because that always helps us connect with new listeners. And we'll catch you next time on the Big Picture Podcast.